AppMedic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose of education and inspiration in the healthcare field.
Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Daniela, a student at Oxford University.
And this is
the AppMedic Podcast. Enjoy!
In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Jay Austin, Chief of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at Massachusetts General Hospital. We discussed the story behind how he became chief and his work leading an active translational research laboratory with dozens of patents and three companies to his name. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about healthcare leadership or just intrigued about how you bring research from bench to bedside. So without further ado, let's have a listen. But before we get into the episode, I want to tell you briefly about our sponsor, Amboss. Created by a team of dedicated physicians from around the world, Amboss is an interactive library of over 20,000 medical topics interlinked with a question bank holding more than 5,500 clinical case-based questions. With all the necessary resources in one place, Amboss instantly delivers up-to-date medical knowledge to students, physicians, and faculty globally. Amboss has powerful learning and clinical tools combined into one platform, making studying a breeze and life on the wards easier. With the Amboss library and question bank side by side, students can look up terms instantly when solving questions. Students and physicians around the world use Amboss material to excel in their exams and on the wards. So sign up in minutes at amboss.com. You can try Amboss risk-free with a trial today. Now, onto the episode. Hi, Dr. Austin. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. So we normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to go into medicine?
That's a short but big question. Well, I think like a lot of your audience, when I was in high school, I had an interest in science. My father was a heart surgeon, so I had some exposure to the medical side part of it. But you know, that was just kind of what I always gravitated to was biology and chemistry. But truthfully, and I think it relates to what we're talking about today, what I always wanted to be from the time I was 15 or 16 was an inventor. And, you know, like a lot of things in life, sort of hard to imagine how you make a career out of that. But that was always in the back of my mind. Was I really always thought of myself as somebody who would invent things when I finally grew up, and maybe eventually I'll grow up.
Awesome. I know that you study actually art history in college. I'm really curious about that. How did that come to be?
Well, you know, as I said, in high school, I had a pretty good idea that I was, you know, likely to end up in medicine. My real interest was actually pediatric. Mm-hmm. I had worked in a laboratory of a very well-known pediatric surgeon, Pat Donahoe, when I was, you know, 15, 16, 17. And that really was interesting to me. And so by the time I got to college, I went to Princeton. I figured, you know, this is my chance to learn other stuff. You know, I'm pretty sure I'm going to go to med school, but I'm interested in a lot of other things, and including art and sort of liberal arts. And they had a great program there. So that's what I did. And it was a lot of fun. Now, as opposed to, you know, your UK audience, you know, we have the ability to study a lot of different things in college. Now, I still had to get the requirements out of the way, but I really banged those out early, took organic chemistry at Harvard in the summer, and just spent the rest of my time doing courses I wanted to.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of similarly for me. I figured that I'm going to study medicine for the rest of my life. I'm studying history of science right now. Give a little broader perspective.
Sure.
And, you know, I want to fast forward a little bit now to the fact that you're now chief of plastic and reconstructive surgery at Massachusetts General Hospital. So taking a 30,000 foot view, I'd love to broadly discuss your career trajectory from sort of studying art history at Princeton to becoming chief at MGH, because I think our listeners will find that story really interesting. So to ask more directly, how do you become chief?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's if you really want me to get to 30 or even 60 or 100,000 feet, I have a lot of people who come to me for advice, from high school students, college students, med students, residents, faculty, professors from other places, chiefs from other places. And, you know, the answer to the big question is often, you know, the same, which is there's a number of things you got to do. One is you got to be completely honest with yourself as well as with others about who you are, what you are. Just because you're a great science student and always get straight A's and everybody says you should go to Harvard and go to Harvard Med School and do these other things doesn't mean you should, right? Only you can sort of answer that. The second thing is, and you see that every day, at every level in my organization, there's always somebody trying to move up. And some of them should and will, and others just shouldn't. They are where they should be, where they're happy. And I think that's a critical thing to always be thinking about. The second thing is, and I think the best example of this is, you know, when students, medical students come to me to talk about residency, you know, I will say to them, look, we're not looking for the best medical student. We may not even be looking for the best resident. What we're really looking for is someone we're going to hire someday. And so what does that all mean? That means that you have to believe in who you are, what you are, what you're going to be. If you don't believe it, nobody else will. And you have to behave that way. I can't tell you how many faculty from our place or other places will come to me and say, gee, I want to be a chief someday. I'll say, really? If your chief dropped dead tomorrow, if I dropped dead tomorrow, are people going to look around and say, oh, it should be you? Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are sort of surprised by that. But in the end, that's really what it's all about. I mean, it should be so obvious that you're the one to be chief that it's not a struggle. And that's kind of how I got through things. I mean, you know, there's an old saying, and it goes, I've attributed to a lot of people, you know, you make your own luck and you make it through hard work and some planning. So how did I go? You know, I was an art history major at Princeton. And guess what? I loved art history. You love the history of science. I had great grades because of that. Because I was doing those courses, I had time to do some of the extracurriculars that people were interested in. I got my EMT license and rode on ambulances. I worked in laboratories. I did, you know, all the things I enjoyed doing, which continued to confirm my thoughts that I might like medicine. In medicine, I thought I wanted to do surgery, probably pediatric surgery, but fortunately kept an open mind because in medical school, I was exposed somewhat, it was just one of these random things where somebody came in and gave a lecture on craniofacial surgery. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, maybe this pediatric plastic surgery is the way to go. This is really cool. From there, I went into surgery training. You know, ultimately, actually, I loved everything in surgery. I loved neurosurgery. I loved urology. There's probably a lot of things I could have done, but I developed this passion for pediatric plastic surgery, which I then pursued. I actually trained in plastic surgery here at Harvard and then spent a year in Melbourne, Australia, studying craniofacial and pediatric, and came back to the Mass General really with the idea that I was going to be the chief of pediatric plastic surgery, I was going to be chief of myself, right? Because I was really developing the program. And that's what I started to do. But as I got here, loved all of plastic surgery. There was more than enough to do of a lot of different things. Established a real basic science laboratory. And, you know, just put my head down. I was working hard. But it was just an interesting time of growth for our group. When I came on board, it was a pretty small group, sort of three or four surgeons. And I just saw opportunity. You know, there was just a lot of obvious things that needed to be done. We were a group that was spread out around the plant. There was thoughts, gee, maybe we should be in one place. Maybe there'd be some economies of scale. And the senior people, including the previous chief, who were wonderful surgeons and great leaders and great teachers, that just wasn't the world they grew up in. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of fell to me to help organize those things. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And once we came together, there just was a need for somebody to you know, keep doing that. And when the previous chief wanted to step down, move on to other things, there wasn't even a search. I mean, people said, well, gee, Jay's kind of already doing it. Mm-hmm. Now, at that point, I had only been in practice about 5 years. So I was pretty young to be a chief. And it was an opportunity for me to sort of step back and say, all right, this is going to be a lot more work. That's not clinical. It's not what I trained for. you know, they don't train you in medical school to run things, certainly not run a business. And to really be successful in science, even at that time, you know, you had to spend a lot of time in it. You had to write grants. It takes a lot of time. You really need to focus on that. And I just didn't think I could do good service for all of it, but I didn't want to give up, you know, innovating. Right. And, you know, I really just took the opportunity to rethink who I was and what I was doing, which was I was interested in translational research. Mm-hmm. So not so much interested in discovering the basic elements of basic science, although it's still interesting to me and still look at those things, but more what problems do we want to solve? What problems do we think we can solve? And how can we get those ideas to patients? And I really didn't know that much about it, but fortunately, I'm surrounded here at MGH by a lot of people who've done it. People like Rox Anderson, who had invented the fractional laser and the CoolSculpt machine and lots of other things you've heard of. You know, we had a fair bit of interaction, and that was somewhat inspiring to me. And we just did it. You know, you just gotta decide today. I'm an innovator, and just do it.
Right.
And that's what we did. And over time became pretty good at it. Now we've started three companies. One is sold. One is also FDA approved product. That's just had a major launch, doing very well. And, you know, another in, you know, well into development. Mm-hmm. And lots of other things on the block.
Right.
So it's just deciding who you want to be and do it. Pretty simple.
Right. And, you know, you've been the chief of plastic and reconstructive surgery now for almost 15 years. So I wanted to talk to you about your style of leadership and what you think makes an effective leader versus an ineffective one.
Great. It's a great question. And I think there are a lot of ways to be an effective leader. So firstly, for me, I had a couple of rules. One is, you know, the old Tip O'Neill quote, you know, all politics are local. You know, and just as I shifted my laboratory research, I definitely shifted my aspirations and societies and things like that. And I've enjoyed the work that I've done in the national societies, but my focus was, look, I'm not going to become president of the American College of Surgeons. I'm going to really focus on this sort of stuff. Not that I would have been anyway. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think when you become chief, it's no longer about you. Mm-hmm. Right. Academic medicine is a lot of it is about self-promotion, right? Because you go to an academic place and you're part of what you're supposed to do is get promoted. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't get promoted to a professor at Harvard unless you're kind of known locally, nationally, internationally as really one of the experts in that area. And to do that, there's a certain element of self-centeredness to do that. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly a lot of generous professors at Harvard, but you know, because, you know, most of us are here to teach and bring other people along. But to be a great chief, you really have to spend a significant amount of time really thinking about other people. And so I have my style is more on the ground, although our group has gotten much, much bigger. And that requires, you know, formal staff meetings and things like that. The way I run things is, you know, I'm here. I actually do operate. I try to do all the things that the rest of my group does, meaning see patients in the clinic, operate, do research, so that I have an understanding of what's happening, what's the environment, what's changing. And I try to be fair, meaning I really try to make it an environment where everybody has kind of the same opportunity, same resources, same amount of OR time, things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, there are cases where, you know, somebody wants to spend half their time in the laboratory versus somebody who wants to be fully clinical. And you have to, you know, weigh apples and oranges to keep it fair. But I think it's about keeping things fair, not many of people on this are parents, but, you know, as a parent, you can't play favorites. You have to, you know, do your best for all of your children, even if you have favorites. And, you know, create opportunities that you would want.
Yeah.
Right. So every time I hire somebody, I try to put together a job that I personally would take, not one, we need somebody to do what nobody else wants to do.
Yeah.
I have that conversation every day. I had that conversation today about some of the physician extenders we're looking to hire. And, you know, I said to my group, I said, listen, don't come back to me with a job description of what nobody else wants to do. You know, it has to be a job that they would all want. but bringing that person in will help offload everybody and make it fair. So you just constantly have to be checking the tires on those kind of things. And then, you know, you got to be confident enough to bring in people who are smarter than you. So I'm always trying to be bringing people who add value, right, you know, beyond what I have or what some of the other people here have.
Right. Because you learn so much from them. Yeah. I want to talk more about your translational research and your lab. So as you mentioned, and as I know, you lead an active research laboratory and are really, frankly, an authority on device innovation. You have dozens of patents to your name, and as you mentioned, the three companies. I was wondering if you could share one particularly memorable or instructive story where you're making that jump from sort of the medical sciences to your patent or a company.
Sure. Well, yeah, like there's a number of things we talk about. You know, I mentioned Rox Anderson. He's so good at this discussion. You know, he always talks about the magic wand. And, you know, we are surrounded by really innovative, smart people, students and residents. And I think everybody on my floor has a good idea every day. Mm-hmm. But usually they're iterative, right? It's a slightly better mouse trap. You know, one of my famous quotes by Henry Ford is, you know, if I ask my customers what they wanted, they say a faster horse. Right. And so every day people are coming up with versions of, you know, getting the horse faster. But, you know, Rox says, look, you want a magic wand. And what that means is imagine if you're in the clinic doing what you do every day and we hand you a magic wand, which will solve, you know, a big problem. But what is that problem? What is that thing that you're seeing every day that's just not solved? And so for plastic surgery, it could be radiation injury or, you know, the problems we have with breast reconstruction, you know, not just a slightly better, you know, breast implant, but something really transformative. And I think that's really the goal, mm-hmm, is to think in that way. So one of the more interesting projects, which has turned into a company that is called Citrellis, so full disclosure, you know, I founded and I'm a consultant and an owner of the Citrellis. Mm-hmm. Many years ago, I had become I was chief of plastic, but I also became chief of the burn surgery. Mm-hmm. So, you know, after a few years of doing an okay job in plastic surgery, they asked me to take that one on. And so I had to start thinking about new problems. And although scar and the treatment of scar is a big part of plastic surgery, it's like an every second of every day thinking in burn surgery. So I had to really focus a bit more on that. And at that time, people were really starting to report on improvement in scar with lasers, so fractional lasers. And I had to really think about developing a laser group, laser center here, because we just didn't have one. Mm-hmm. Now, that I found that very daunting. I didn't know anything about lasers. So I hadn't really trained lasers. We didn't have any lasers in plastic surgery here. They're expensive. There's lots of different types. They're dangerous. They're powerful. You know, just a very expensive device in all ways. I started thinking about it. It's like, boy, you know, it's like using a battleship to knock down your front door. It's this huge amount of energy to make these tiny little holes. And there are various complications around it. You know, at that time, I was doing a lot of work at the Shrine with scar. I still work at the Shriners Burn Hospital once a month, mostly with the cleft lip kids. But that time I was doing more scar. And, you know, if you have a kid with dark skin from any part of the world, you know, it's not necessarily a great way to treat them because there's all sorts of problems. You know, there's not many lasers in Africa or Asia for this reason. So I'm learning about the laser. At the same time, in plastic surgery, people started doing something called needling. So they were using just solid needles, you know, rolling them on people's faces, and in some patients getting what they described as rejuvenation. So I had this crazy idea. Why can't I do what they do with the laser with needles? Mm-hmm. Just a simple idea. And a lot of people who I brought it up to said, you're crazy. That's insane. Why would you do that? And it was actually Rox. He came to talk to me about some other project. And I, at the end of that meeting, said, gee, Rox, I got this crazy idea. What do you think? And he said, well, I mean, I've already solved that problem. It's a fractional laser, but I think it'll probably work and might be interesting for you to putz around with it and sort of, you know, gave me some suggestions of people to talk to. And yeah, just, you know, we've filed a bunch of IP around this simple idea. And then you know, did I just did what we did literally one animal experiment. I had to really convince my fellows to do it, but my researchers didn't want to do it. They thought it was a waste of time. I actually convinced one of the guys who, you know, in July, we always rotate the fellows, you know, and so a new fellow comes on board. And first thing I says, I've got this great project for you. It'll be really fun. And, you know, he was ignorant enough to do it. One experiment worked great, you know, and the rest is history. I mean, that, you know, from that raised $3 million. Mm-hmm. And started a company. Wow. And that company now 10 years later is FDA approved and really taking off. I mean, we're looking at significant sales next mm-hmm. year. But most importantly, you know, the docs are saying this is something really new. We can really do things with this that we can't do with other things. And that's really exciting to me.
Before we get back to the episode, a brief word from our sponsors. Amboss is a medical knowledge platform built on three fundamental elements. At the core, a comprehensive medical library helps students learn the facts and the nuances of medicine. Also central is the QBank. By using these tools, students unlock the third element, personalized analytics, which helps students make smart studying decisions. Three essential tools of learning, all in one place. It's no surprise Amboss has become one of the most popular resources for students and schools worldwide. Ready to take a closer look? Sign up for a free trial today at amboss.com.
Now, back to the episode. So I think we covered a little bit of this, but just across your range of experience, range of bringing things to the bedside, what are some of the key challenges in making that translation?
Well, there's a lot. You know, I have a whole lecture on this. You know, first you have to, you know, you have to have something that you can protect. So lots of great ideas. I mean, there's no new great ideas, right? So, you know, a lot of ideas have either been written about or studied or other people have filed patents on, and that can be a problem. You know, no matter how altruistic you are, the money does matter. If people can't make money on your idea, even though you don't care about money, it can be hard to move it forward because, you know, money is what is required to get through what they call the valley of death. You know, the valley of death is, all right, I've got my idea. How do I get to patients? And there's a lot of things that can kill you. The regulatory can kill you. You know, FDA can come in and say, well, that's a combination device or even a drug. And suddenly it costs a lot of more money and a lot more time. You know, there's reimbursement issues. You have some new idea, but who's going to pay for it? Is the patient paying for it? Will insurance pay for it? How do you get to that point? You know, you always have to get through the science. I mean, just because something works in animals does not mean it's going to work in humans. And that, of course, you know, cancer and traumatic injury have been cured many, many times in animals, and we haven't quite solved those problems in humans. So, you know, there's lots of things that can go wrong. There are a lot of just problems that are inherent to startups that can make things go sideways. But, you know, I think the best way to learn them is just to do it. You got to make, like everything, you got to make mistakes and learn and get better at it.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly. And I think, I mean, the valley of death, I've heard the term before, but I imagine that's part of the reason why a lot of research, right, it gets published and then just sits on a dusty old shelf, right, in a journal somewhere, and that's about it. And I think there is also just some physicians are worried about translation, or that's not what interests them. I guess my question to you is, what are some?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. You know, I go to lots of different conferences and lectures, and every once in a while, you'll see this amazing lecture on some really disruptive finding. And I will always go up to the scientists and be like, what are you doing? And half the time they'll say, oh, yeah, we're already starting a company and I'm working with this guy. And I get, but the other half, it's like, that's not my interest. You know, my interest is in getting another grant and just solving these problems for humanity. It's just fascinating. You know, who you are really matters in this. And there's no right answer. I certainly don't in any way look down on those people who are making those seminal discoveries. We need those people. That's where real innovation comes from. But it is quite interesting how some people just have zero interest in it.
Right. So I guess my question for you is, like, what responsibility do you think physicians and these researchers have to translate their basic science findings, so it's not just sitting on a dusty old shelf somewhere?
Yeah, I don't blame the the actual researcher, you know. I think that's unfair. But I do think that the institutions bear responsibility. I think they have to do the best they can to just keep track of what people are doing and, you know, make those connections when they're needed, right? And I think educating the researcher on what to do and what not to do to kill an idea. I mean, I really became very involved in this around a situation like that. I mean, I was interested in this. I was actually working on my fat grafting technology. And somebody had come to me because they knew what I was doing and wanted me to be a consultant. And so I had to get the institution involved. And they looked at it and they really wanted to get a picture of what I was doing. And we were about to go off to Europe and give a lecture on this. And they, you know, their heads exploded. They're like, no, you can't. If you go and give this lecture, we can't, you haven't filed IP on this, this, and this. And, you know, gave us a real crash course on what matters for IP. And so, you know, I think that it is on the institutions a bit and on us to educate our scientists, you know, just on the basics, you know, even if they're not interested, just say, look, you know, if you think you've solved something that's going to turn into a Nobel Prize, that's great, but come talk to us so we can protect it for you.
No, that's funny. And I guess that relates to an earlier point you made that one thing that medical schools don't teach you is how to run a company, right? So I guess beyond this point about IP, are there other like lessons about running a company or starting a company that you think medical schools don't teach you, but are still like valuable lessons and things to know?
Again, we don't have enough time, but yeah, you know, there's lots and lots and lots and lots of lessons that, you know, a lot smarter people than I, and, you know, you can teach these things, right? You know, I get asked all the time, you know, oh, why don't you go to business school? And, you know, my previous boss had a really funny quote about this because, you know, he ran a big group and I run four divisions right now in a wound center, you know, so I run a lot of different things. And why? Well, just like surgery, you get better at it the more you do it. So I've gotten better as a manager. I've got great teams. And we have a shorthand on getting things done. And, you know, these things just get better over time. But anyway, so one of my previous chiefs of surgery had a great line about this. You know, he's like, yeah, people ask me why I don't get my MBA. He goes, because I got two of them down the hall who work for me. You know what I mean? And, you know, he was kind of that way. But I mean, I have great MBAs who work with me. You know, I have a guy named Mike McCormick who came to work with me right after college. Mm-hmm. And his degree was in biology and he was my lab tech. And from there he became my lab manager. And from there he went to get his MBA. And now he and I've started a bunch of, you know, companies together and have IP together. And it's a real team. And it's the same with my divisions. There's a number of MBAs who are fabulous who, you know, work with me and we're a real team. So anyway,
yeah.
My advice is the same as, you know, decide who you want to be and start doing it. You know, that's the thing. Don't worry about what other people say you can and can't do. Don't get hung up on labels. You know, I think it's, you know, the dumbest thing a scientist could do is put on their laboratory door, scientist, you know, John Smith, stem cell or CRISPR-Cas9 or whatever, because that label, you know, just put you in a corner. Mm-hmm. And I prefer to think of myself as an innovator, right, and not necessarily a plastic surgeon or a doctor or whatever, but you know, an innovator, because that allows me to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that nearly wraps up the episode, but something we ask every person before we go is what are three pieces of advice you'd give students interested in healthcare leadership and medical device development? I know we've discussed some of these, but to distill them down into three pieces.
Three pieces of advice. Well, first I'd say advice is worthless. That, right? I mean, remember that, because, you know, it's one of the more annoying things of academic medicine to me is, you know, I have a lot of trainees and I spend a lot of time trying to advise them, but they will come to me with a lot. Oh, gee, this person says this, and this person says that, and I think when you tell people what to do, you're not helping them. Mm-hmm. What you need to do is help them figure out how they should think about various problems and various issues. Every once in a while, you just got to tell somebody like they're being crazy, you know. But advice is useless. That's important to remember. Two, you know, be honest, be really, really honest. Just because you're the smartest kid at Harvard doesn't mean you should go to Harvard Med School, you know, just because your mom says you should be a doctor. You know, really try to be honest with who you want to be. Mm-hmm. And if what you want to do is be a cosmetic plastic surgeon and have a boat on a lake, great. I'll help you do that. You know, if you want to run a department somewhere, great. I'll try to help you do that. You know, in the end, you got to be happy. So I think life is, it's silly to say, but it's about figuring out what makes you happy. And, you know, I think medicine and science gives you a lot to be happy about. Really, it's really interesting. It's really rewarding. And it's rarely boring. So, you know, for me, it's a pretty good place for a lot of people to start anyway.
Well, thanks so much, Dr. Austin. I really appreciate your time.
A pleasure. Pleasure. Good luck to all of you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.